tc.edu. Welcome to Generation Now, the show by and for millennials and Gen Z on WGTD FM. I'm your host, Troy McDonald. In the wake of the trauma and uncertainty that was basically the entire year of 2020, my guests today are bringing the community together through an innovative community organization called Kenosha Coalition Organizing Resolution, or Kenosha CORE. I am so excited to welcome Brianna Nelson, the chairman of Kenosha CORE, Nick Dennis, president of Kenosha CORE, and Minister Khalif Moob El, executive director and co-founder of Kenosha CORE. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you for having us.
So I'll toss this out to whoever wants to answer, but let's start from the beginning. How was KCORE formed? Where did the impetus come from?
Well, the impetus came from, of course, we all started out with the Jacob Blake uprisings or protests. I don't really like to call them uprisings because there really wasn't a lot of uprising. It was just a couple of days of that. And then the precision of that was on the back end was just basically protesting. A lot of it was peaceful protesting. A good percentage of it was peaceful protesting. Maybe about 95% of it was about peaceful protesting, because the cohort of organizers didn't come together and start protesting until after the uprising happened, which was a chemical response to the shooting of Jacob Blake Jr. And as a result of that, people reacted the way they wanted to react. And there was no organizational structure. There was no nothing behind that. It was just raw emotion. I started off at an event that Portia Bennett Bay had thrown. And at that event, there was the mayor, there was the deputy chief of police then, a couple of alder people. And I did a presentation. And part of that presentation was about policing, the culture of policing, alternatives to policing strategies and things of that nature. And in the process of that, at the conclusion of that, Chief Larson walked up to me and wanted to know more about some of the things that we had done in Madison and whether or not we could bring that here to Kenosha. And subsequent to that, he and I, Greg Bennett and Brianna Nelson, we began to meet in a little coffee shop for the following three weeks. And then subsequent to that, we said that we needed to form a coalition of people who were not only influential in the community, but had an impact in the community. And these were activists that we had reached for, and some other people had referenced that were making the noise in the streets the right way, that had a good prominent voice, influence, and was also recognized by the community, because interrupting is very, it hinges upon very largely the influence that the interrupter has in his community. So we met for about 8-9 months consecutively, faithfully, every single week, rain, snow, sleet, storm, whatever. We met and we began to form what we know today as the Kenosha CORE. Our people were highly trained in various different areas, from trauma-informed care, conflict resolution, anger management, peer support, peer mediation, peer mentoring, mixed martial arts, or what we call spatial awareness. We embarked on a journey to prepare ourselves before we hit the streets. And the group that continued to meet and meet and meet and meet, some 15 or 20 people that are still here today, is what makes up Kenosha CORE, a cohort of volunteers who are passionate about this work and about restoration of our community.
And folks, this is President Nick Dennis who's speaking now.
Yeah, and so how I came about with the Kenosha CORE, like I said, I was, like he said, we was, you know, protesting. I was just doing a lot. We weren't like burning nothing up, but, you know, we wanted to stand up for Jacob at the time. You know, and still now we want to stand up for him. But at the same time, it just brought out, you know, we wanted to see more done for Kenosha. And so I just stumbled across this the group that was meeting up. You know, I just barged in, I took a seat, I listened to everybody who was talking. I found it interesting and I felt like it was doing something for the people. So I joined.
Well, it seems like the growth has been amazing over the last few months. How many calls have you responded to? How many members? I think, Minister, you said that you have about 15, 20 volunteers. Am I correct?
Yeah, 20
on that.
Yeah, 20 volunteers. And trust me, it's about time for them to get some money. you know, this, you got to understand that our lives are in danger every single day. Our families are on hold every single day. We're on call 24/7. I can get a phone call at 2 o'clock in the morning from the president, or the president can get a call from me at that time, or our dispatcher, and we got to jump up out of our bed. And myself, I got to travel all the way from Milwaukee in 30, 40 minutes, and they got to already be on the ground. And so it's never really a restful situation. Mm-hmm. Just like the community is on edge, that's how the interrupters are. We're on edge because the community is on edge. Until we're able to stabilize the community, then the interrupters, we can't be stable.
How many calls have you responded to? I'm guessing it must be in the hundreds, more than that.
We responded to a lot of calls. I couldn't give you a precise number, but
I can say this:
we responded to a lot of calls, and we walked up on situations that we weren't even called to. And so it's been very busy. Put it that way.
Yeah, I was just going to say, man, you can't even put a number on how many you will lose count, you know, because like I said, it's not just us. Different members come across different situations. So I can tell you myself that I done came across 20 or 30 by myself, but another member might have came across 15, 20 himself. And, you know, once we get to the spot, we all come together sometimes, you know, the ones that's on all hands on deck. You know, it's different. It's an all hands on deck, and it's cases that's not that serious. So we don't pop up 100 deep or 20 deep every time we come out. Some situations might be minor where it only takes two or three core members to show up, you know, just to de-escalate some situations that we have in the community. So yeah, that number is crazy.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Brianna, I want to go to you on kind of the operations here, as Minister was alluding to. How do you get a call? How do you assess situations on the ground? Kind of walk the layperson through kind of what you guys do on a daily basis.
Absolutely. So sometimes we don't receive calls like Nick and the president said. We'll just, you know, we'll be in the community canvassing, just making sure the community is stabilized, and an incident may come up where a child has lost their book bag or their bike, or, you know, different situations like that, and or are at home without their parents, and, you know, the parents want us to check on the home. So it's different situations like that where we stumble upon, or some of the community members have direct contact with us, and that is through a dispatch number. The calls are dispatched to our field interrupters that are on the ground, and they pretty much take up about four corners of the community. And so we all have our own schedule or our own days where we're to be out in the field. A lot of times our significant others may be out and about, and they may tell us something is going on that might turn into something, arguments, or even some of our friends that go out to the nightclubs, they call us if they think that some issues might uprise in the parking lot. So it's a lot of different ways. It's just us making sure we're in tune with what's going on in the community, because not all the time someone is going to call. This is a community effort, so we have to be out there with them.
And this might be hard to answer because things vary so much, but as you've been doing this for a moment now, is there a type of case that you're seeing often and that you kind of go, oh, well, we know what to do here. We've done this, you know, a million times. Let's send this field interrupter out. Are there patterns that are emerging?
Well, we've... It's been a lot of shootings. We've had about three or four homicides already. We've had, I don't know how many shootings. We've had a few standoffs, and it's been a lot of conflict in the neighborhood between the younger people. So these acts of violence or these potential threats of violence have been kind of a common place for our interrupters. When we respond to a situation, we always assess it as a very dangerous and arduous situation and circumstance. Now, whatever makes up the, whatever interrupter arrives there on the scene in our rapid response approach, they will give us a drop on everything that's going on there, and we'll know what to do from that particular trajectory.
All the situations that we've run on so far has been different. Like the minister said, we have a about three murders, a lot of domestics, a lot of people not getting along or don't want to talk to the police. You got, like I said, you have situations and it's different. Some might be domestic, some might not be. It might just be an argument and the police was called, and you know, we just trying to eliminate the going to jail part. Just because the police show up to an argument, it doesn't mean that somebody has to go to jail. So the Corps pops up on scenes like that just to de-escalate that situation, just in case it turned to a double de-escalation that we might have to do. So, you know, like I said, a lot of situations be different, but for the last 2 months, it's been murder.
Unreal. We're going to touch on that in a moment. But the question I'm about to ask might be controversial, and quite frankly, I don't care. In a lot of ways, you are seemingly doing the grassroots community work that traditional police departments are afraid to do, unwilling to do, especially in Black and Brown communities here in Kenosha. Do you see yourself that way, as kind of intervening because other people are just not willing to do the training necessary to do this work, which is critically important? Or do you see yourself as more of a bridge to those relationships? And I'll toss this out to the minister.
No one entity can do everything. And with respect to law enforcement has committed to a side of arresting, and that is how they deal with matters. They haven't committed to the side of, they do some de-escalation. However, social services is not one of the things that law enforcement does. Peer mentoring, peer mediation, those things law enforcement don't do. And a lot of those things we don't want law enforcement to do. A lot of the law enforcement, the police department, the KPD is largely Caucasian or European descent. Maybe about like 99%, right? 98, 99, something like that, right? These are people who in no way can relate to our demographic of people, our culture, or anything like that. And then when you look at the culture of policing over the many years, including from the slave patrols and things of that nature, there's a thing called post-traumatic slave syndrome that our people subconsciously suffer from, okay? In addition to that, every 28 hours in this country, a so-called Black or Brown person is gunned down by police unjustly, all right? So when you couple that with the fear, with the implicit bias, the overt bias, the culture of racism in the department, all over the country, right? And when we're stemming from a situation where there is a situation that has created a distrust for law enforcement in reference to our people are not going to have a good experience with law enforcement. So the Kenosha Corps, we believe strongly where we are. Our program is broken into three parts. The first part of our program is the prevention of violence. So what do we do to prevent violence? We know that some of the critical mitigating factors or some of the things that give rise to violence is poverty. That's one of the main things that give rise to violence. The second thing that gives rise to violence is not just poverty, but also inaccessibility, the lack of access to resources to cure or to extricate the load of impoverishment in the community. And the third thing that gives rise to violence is inopportunity. Having no opportunities, no alternatives for our youth in the community, no alternatives for the adults in the community, like the parents and things of that nature. And the other thing is the divide in the household. This is a plague of mass incarceration of so-called Black men in America, the over-incarceration of them, the rise of the youth in the incarceration system. By the age of 17, most of them end up in the system or have been touched by incarceration in some respect, whether they're impacted directly or indirectly impacted. And when we look at how the community has been gutted within industry, there is no industry in the community. Jobs are outsourced. And so we're going to have a situation where there's a lot of social deterrents that create the rise of violence in the community. Now, the police goes into that cesspool illy equipped to connect with the community directly. The impact is only going to be arrest, because the response to law enforcement naturally is going to be a volatile one, coming from our people's perspective. So the Kenosha Court is definitely a bridge, because we can't eliminate police. It's things that the police do that the Kenosha Court can't do. There are things that the Kenosha Court does that the police can't do and simply won't do. Outside of the prevention is the rapid response. The rapid response piece is when there is a violent act or there's a commission or during the commission of a crime or something, we come after the fact and we work on the mechanics in that situation right there on the spot, whether it's going to be retaliation, whether it's a parent or something like that going crazy about the loss of their child and beating up and going to create a situation where they're going to get arrested. We're there to interrupt, to modify the circumstances in that situation and to lessen the impact of the violent act that has taken place. And the third thing we do is interrupt. If there is someone in the commission, during the commission of a crime, and it's a reason, it's a way that we can step in, stop it before it morphs into a felony or before it morphs into a crime, or there's a violent act about to happen, if we allow the follow through to take place, we step in and we do that. We don't want people to be arrested. We don't want people to end up in jail or prison. We don't want people to lose their lives permanently. Our job is not only to be there to make sure that that don't happen, if we can help it, but also create alternatives in the community to eliminate the possibility that we can have a 17, a 18, a 19-year-old lose their lives to the system or take another life because of senselessness. The responsibility to liberate us is upon us, and no one else from the exile, from the outside, is going to come in and do the work that we're supposed to do on us. And so if we can eliminate the external sources that's coming in to create the fervor in the community so that we can get back to us, that right there gives us a greater opportunity to restore our communities. And that's where we are.
That was powerful. How have your interactions been with young people as you're having these conversations? As you said, providing that alternative, how do you instill hope in a community where there isn't, some would say, maybe not a reason to be? How do you give them, hey, hold on, stay in it, stay in the fight, when they might not be seeing anything else? I'll start with Brianna.
Yes, I believe that we bring a lot of hope to the community by just being there. The presence of us being there. We can't be on the scene with the police a lot of times, you know, it's like boundaries and different things like that. But just the fact that they know that we're in the vicinity of a situation, that brings them hope, like right in the middle of a crisis, I see. And then doing block parties and having the interaction and introducing what Kenosha Court is has brought a lot of hope and understanding of what is violence interruption. You know, what is this 15-point plan that they speak of, making our presence known in the community by doing restoration, but these restoration block parties every summer is really going to bring the hope. And well, you know, money brings hope. And so we are professional beggars for the community. And it's only fair that the community can thrive off of what the community is owed.
Yeah, I was going to go to Nick. You know, that you're a Black man who's out on the streets here too, Nick. And how do you relate to Black men who, from the conversations I've had, not as much as the work you're doing, of course, but there's a disregard for the political system, and understandably so, the policing system. How do you even begin those conversations with young Black men?
You know, like I said, you got to be a big brother to the community. And that's the big part. That's the most important piece of the Kenosha Corps. The people got to look at you already as somebody, because you already been making noise, fighting for people, talking to the mayor, council board members, and so on and so on. But when you go into these neighborhoods, the kids are out there playing and doing what they want to do. Ain't nobody, you know, the parents are doing other things to take their focus off the kids. So when they see me and some of the core members come through the neighborhood, they want to listen. When we throw these block parties, that just put the icing on the cake. Now you looking at me as a big brother. I want the young guys to look at the Kenosha Corps as brothers and sisters, because when we come to help you. We come to ask you what you need. We come to ask you if you need a ride to school, if your teachers and if what's going on in your life. You know, a lot of kids ain't got that. So when they look at the Corps, we come in there for free. We come in to see what the real problem is. What y'all need something to eat? Oh, matter of fact, man, you won't believe some of the I'm talking about like 7, 8 don't even want to go to school. But once we throw these block parties and constantly talk to them every week, constantly be in the neighborhoods every day, they see you more. They look up to you more, because now they know you stand for something that's in the community. So when the kids see that, now they want to talk to you. Now they want to, hey, when y'all going to throw us another block party? You want them. That's how you start to, first you ease yourself in. It's about putting the foot in the door first. And then once you got your foot in the door, because believe me, the kids are way tougher than we was when we was kids. So it's harder to put that foot in the door. So once you get that foot in the door, it's time to open up the whole door for the Corps, because we come in to help you.
We're coming towards the end here. Man, this has gone by quick. I just want to ask about your mental health. As you said, you're on call 24/7. This is a daunting task for private citizens, volunteers, to take on not only their own PTSD, post-traumatic disorder from slavery, generationally, the experiences you may have had growing up, but then also taking that burden on for your entire community and those who interact with K-Corps. How are you holding up? And I'll start with Minister, and we'll go around here to then Brianna and then Nick.
Well, that's a good question, you know, because I do 1,001 other things as well, in addition to violence interruptions and developing programs and stuff across the country. So mental health for me, my therapy comes through the people. Like, I did 10 years in solitary confinement and in the worst prison in the country. And, you know, they labeled me a terrorist, top 25 terrorists, all kind of things. You know, they put all kind of labels on me, worst of the worst. And things of that nature. And what's crazy is I didn't even kill nobody. I didn't rape. I didn't do none of that stuff. In that situation, in that solitude, where people were wanting to kill themselves and end it all, because there was no solace, there was no kind of relief or any of that stuff in sight, I would find myself counseling these people, talking them off the ledge of suicide. And I knew for myself that I was speaking to myself at the same time I was speaking to them. When I was talking them off the ledge, I was talking myself off the ledge. When I understood the power of the words that I spoke to them and how it hit them, I felt the same impact on my heart. And so my therapy comes through being able to impact the people and to speak life into them so I can keep life in me. That's where my therapy comes from.
So my therapy comes from, I have a whole support team. I have a sponsor. I have all the tools in my toolbox that I need to have a stable to have stability in my mental health. There really for me hasn't been times where I've came across something that was more traumatic than I've personally been through. So I think I'm a little bit desensitized. So that kind of helps me processing certain things. I've been there. I've done it. I've grew up in poverty. You know, people don't think it when they look at me. I've been to jail. I've done certain things that have shook me and rocked my my entire life. And I think and losing a parent. I think that when you've had the worst of the worst and you've bounced back and you know like how to use all your tools in the toolbox, you have something to hold on to, but there will be a piece and a time that we will have counselors for us, for our executive members and for membership. I'm sure that will be much needed, you know, down the line. And yeah, I know that that will be in place, but right now we're using our own support systems. We find support in each other. We have support circles that will be in the making, and peace circles that we'll do in conjunction with the police. So there's quite a few tools in our toolbox. So there's no excuse for us to not keep moving, not keep the fight in us, and lay down. And like Brother Khali said, there's no laying down and fighting. We're some stand up fighters, and we won't stop.
And for me, it's just basically having strong people around you. It's kind of hard to slip when you got people telling you to move forward. It's hard to slip when you got people calling your phone saying, hey, I need you to come to so-and-so, so-and-so. It's really bad. That's my motivation. Some of the members in the Corps, we do a wellness checks with each other. You know, that'll put us to a place, because you need somewhere to vent to. And why not go in-house? You know, everything about me is in-house. My family is my support system. My team is my support system. And me, myself and I, is my own support system, because I can't wake up in a day without thinking something has to be done, you know. And so I keep it moving like that. That's what's been keeping me motivated and moving forward.
How can people help? How can people donate and make sure that this continues to go on and serve our community?
All right, I will take that. So we have a Cash App, and our Cash App handle is Kenosha Corps 262.
And I guess a follow-up to that, have you guys sought grants or other kinds of funding mechanisms to keep this going? Or is it really just community driven at this point?
At this point, we are seeking grants. We did just get approved for the CDGB grant, and that don't come out until next year. A lot of the monies that we're going for won't come out until next year, 2022. So it is community driven. We are relying greatly on the community, and it's been a struggle, no doubt about it. But the struggle has never made us weak. It has only made us stronger, and it only inspires our people to move forward and press even harder. But we know that the work that we're doing is a noble effort. And we know that our hearts are in the right place and that we have the right people with us. So I know that the relief is coming. And when it comes, it's going to come in abundance. And the more we're able to thrive and survive, the more we'll be able to pump those kind of energies and resources back into our community. I'm going to give you an example. We had got like a $20,000 donation, and half of that $20,000 went right back into the community. And it's over 20 people in the Corps. You know, every person could have got $1,000, but we didn't do that. We took half of those resources, and we got a little small stipend for some of the work that we did in training. And the other half we put right back into the community to make sure that the impact, the love, and more importantly, the sustainability is there. And the potential for restoration is definitely always ever present. Like we talked about earlier, people are losing hope. Well, we're there to restore that hope. And that's the most important thing to us.
That's the perfect way to end. I cannot thank you enough. Thank you, Brianna Nelson, Chairman of Kenosha Corps, Nick Dennis, President of Kenosha Corps, and Minister Khalif Muab El, the executive director and co-founder of Kenosha Corps. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Brother Troy. Thank you for having us. It's been a pleasure.
Until next time.